So, feudalism? Any questions on feudalism?
In concept.
All right. So keep in mind, the English kings, as a result of marriages, had possession of a large chunk of French land. And they continued to intermarry, going all the way up to the death of King Charles IV. Ultimately, it was that familial connection that is the reason why his younger sister, Isabella, decided to submit her son, who just happened to be king. He was a child, but he was king of England. Edward III put his name in as a contender to become monarch of France, since, after all, again, England owned half. So it kind of made sense. But ultimately, the barons basically said, no, under the law, property cannot be owned by a woman. So if property cannot be owned by a woman, how could property pass through a woman? Because if you take possession of your father's lands and titles and stuff, it's passing from him to you. So the nobles said no. They invited Edward's second cousin, who was older, Philip, crowned as Philip VI, to become king. Now, ironically, Isabella was just like, okay, fine. She was good with it. But things got complicated when Edward came of age. In 1330, at the age of 17, 2 years before he was legally allowed to be king in his own name, Edward essentially launches a coup against his mother and her lover. The war itself, or the coup, or uprising, whatever you want to call it, was relatively quick. But legally speaking, Isabella technically was the regent. So legally, she was like a guardian. She had a right to make those decisions. But the kid was like, no. And none of the nobles said anything, because the nobles came to hate Isabella's lover. So for the nobles, they were like, ah, who cares about the law? We'll make the king king. He's going to be king in a few years anyways. And thus, he was in charge. But if you look at any king's reign, particularly during this period, there always were lots of issues when parts of his realm would not want that person to be ruling, so they would rise up. As was the case, when shortly after he was in charge, is the Scots. Scotland, which had always been conquered and then sometimes got pseudo-independence and then sometimes full independence, but was eventually conquered again, was part of the English Empire. Well, the Scots decided they did not want to be controlled by Edward. But there was a problem, because Scotland, which had a king who was technically below the King of England, had made an alliance with France. And in support of that alliance, France, under Philip VI, started attacking English land, sending French ships into the channel, attacking the coasts. So in response, Edward started sending money to help out a rebellion in France against Philip. Politics. Dirty, dirty politics. By the way, the same thing still happens in the modern world. FYI. You know, CIA operations. We still do the same thing. Well, long story short, Philip discovers that Edward, who's technically his vassal, is helping the rebels, and he declares all of the English lands in France are going to get stripped away. Well, when that occurred, Edward would declare war. And ultimately, that would be the start of, the Hundred Years' War. All right, I wish I could have finished that off, but we ran out of time last class. Honestly, you following along with the story? I know it's laid out in the books. But any questions? All right, well then here we go. Now what makes the Hundred Years' War challenging is the fact that technically it really wasn't a war, but rather it was three successive mini-wars. And in between each mini-war was a period of peace. Now, it was a war like the way wars used to be fought, not the way they are now. Nowadays, when a war is occurring, there's typically at least fighting incidents everywhere at the same time. Back in these days, you could have a war on and maybe never have a battle. Or you could have a war where there could be 5-10 years in between battles. Because most of the fighting was about laying siege to cities or political maneuvering, where you'd attempt to engage in assassinating your opponent, or you would attempt to try to bribe some of their vassals to switch sides. So there was a lot of politicking going on, there just wasn't a lot of fighting. To make matters even more complicated was how long it lasted. Now, it's called a Hundred Years' War, but it was actually lasted 116 years. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 4 days. What made this type of war complicated with the length was the fact that it encompassed the reigns of 5 English kings and 5 French kings. England's side, it started with Edward III, but it continued through Richard II, Henry IV, 5th and 6th. And in France, it began with Philip VI, went through the reign of John II, Charles V, 6th, and ended with Charles VII. So think about that. We're talking the great-great-great-grandson of the guys that started it with the guys that finished it. Think of how much changes in a single lifetime, let alone nearly 120 years. So, the battles, when they started off using the technology and the tactics of the day, you saw a constant evolution the longer this war went on. Interestingly enough, England actually won most of the battles. And they did so by utilizing their state-of-the-art technology and weapons development. Infantry, armed with pikes, long wooden poles with steel blades at the end, and just commoners firing longbows. Whereas the French, they utilize mostly mounted knights. Nobles wearing plate armor, riding on a heavy war horse, charging at the enemy lines. Of course, getting stuck like pigs on the pikes. That's a story for a different day. But here's the funny thing. England won most of the battles, but in the end, France won the war. With the development of something that had never existed before, which today we call patriotism. In the end, the French people rallied to the king and country and did an us versus them. We're French, we love our country, we love our king, and we hate them. the enemy, the foreign invaders. Although, side note, by the end of the war, France also had developed primitive artillery and firearms. So, at the end of the day, you may be great with your little bow, but if I have a gun, I'm probably going to win. And if I have a cannon, yeah, advantage me. Although, granted, you could go like, poop, 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 stick me with a whole bunch. But, you know, whatever. All right. So, we don't have time to talk about everything happened over the first mini-war. But as you can see, technically it began when Edward declared war on France, after France took his land in 1337. But it would stretch all the way to 1316, 23 years. Are any of you even 23 years old? How old are you? 23 years old. So that meant the moment you popped out of mom up until today, your entire life, that's how long this first war lasted. Put it in context. All right. Now, me being interested in military history, the first war is also the most interesting, but it's also the most destructive. Because what was the big event that we talked about last class that erupted in the 1340s? The plague. So in the midst of them fighting this war, the bubonic plague erupted. How easy do you think it is fighting a war when, you know, one out of every three people die? Now, even though the war started in 1337, the first actual battle didn't take place until 1340. And the first battle wasn't even a land battle. It was a naval battle. Because Edward had to raise an army in England and sail across the English Channel. Now, ironically, the French naval strategy, because they didn't have cannon then, the French naval strategy was similar to the same strategy that the Romans used to use. So what they would do is they would tie all their boats together and basically make a big floating dock out in the water, and then the enemy would have to come and board the ship, and you would fight like you were doing on land. But the English, they didn't have as big a ships. Their ships were smaller and maneuverable. At some point, whoever was in command said, well, that's freaking stupid. And so all they did was sail around the French, shooting at them with arrows. Mostly those lit on fire. Because what happens to a wooden boat when it gets struck with fire arrows? And then what happens?
Burns.
And then?
No ship.
No ship. No crew. Now, how bad was it? Well, the French would lose 16,000 soldiers dead, killed in action at this one battle. Whereas the English would only lose about 400. The English managed to sink 24 of the French ships. Completely knocked out, and they managed to capture another 166. Which suddenly meant England now had full control over the English Channel. They can start moving men and materiel back and forth. Just like what happened in World War II, when the Allies did the Normandy landings. The first major land battle was the Battle of Crécy, which took place. Where's the laser? There we go. It's not showing up on the TV. Oh, you can barely see it. Crécy is way up there, right south of Calais. Because they landed in Calais and they started marching south. Because they were trying to get to not only Paris, but over here is the city of Reims. Reims is symbolically important because that's the city where the French kings were always crowned. So Edward's strategy was basically to not only take over the capital, but take over the place where he can crown himself
King of France.
Now, what happened at Crécy? Well, Crécy was just a small village. The English was outnumbered, about 15,000 to 25,000. But the French fought with knights, and the English were mostly infantry and longbowmen. Edward's forces took the high ground and forced the knights to essentially charge uphill. Now, it was as if God was on England's side because it rained for several days before the battle actually erupted. So the hillside was so muddy, they couldn't charge up on the horse. So they had to dismount, and the knights in heavy armor had to walk up a hill in mud, some places sinking down to their knees. While the English were on top of the hill, taking advantage of gravity. It was completely one-sided. So much so that when Philip, who was there, as was Edward, was injured in battle, the King of France was forced to flee the battlefield. The remaining French soldiers were slaughtered. England took no prisoners. In total, it's estimated that about 4,000 French soldiers lost their lives, including about 1,500 nobles. A huge blow to the ruling system of France. Because now with the noble dead, who controls the estate? Better hope he had a male heir. It would be another 10 years. By the way, Battle of Crécy, this took place in 1346, 6 years after the first technical battle. Then the next major battle, it would take a decade before it took place. And this was the most famous battle of the entire war. The Battle of Poitiers. By this point, Edward is getting up to be an old man. So the commanding officer is his son, Prince Edward. Commonly referred to as the Black Prince. Not because he was black. No, because apparently the armor that he wore, he made sure that the blacksmiths added more, I forgot what mineral you need to put in the flame to basically char the steel. So he wanted his armor to stand out. It wasn't just steel. It wasn't shiny like all the rest. So everyone would know where he was on the battlefield at all time. He's a major alpha dog, by the way. Well, at the Battle of Poitiers, down here, what ended up happening is between the Battle of Crécy and Poitiers, plague erupted. Both sides stopped fighting. So 1354, the plague begins to subside. England returns, but instead of coming from the north-south, the Black Prince decides to take over his bases down in Gascony and begin driving north, hoping that the forces, English forces up here, will essentially be a hammer, or rather an anvil, and his forces driving north would be the hammer. And his hope was to catch the French in between, and basically crush them. Well, the Black Prince also unleashed what we would call terrorism. For months, to get the French forces to come out, he and his men ravaged the countryside. During his most brutal actions, he took his elite cavalry, broke them up into three units, and spread them out. So essentially they were traveling in a 40-mile long line, marching north through the countryside. And they basically destroyed everything they came in contact with, except for the people. So they destroyed the houses, they destroyed the farms, they destroyed the livestock, they destroyed the wells, they destroyed the fields. But they intentionally did not kill the people. Why?
Spread the news.
Well, you're going to spread the news. And what else is going to happen?
Leave them with nothing.
Okay, so what's going to happen to France as a whole?
Well,
because as the migrants have to flee, they're going to go into the places where the English haven't reached yet, and they're going to have to start living off those resources. He was basically trying to grind the English down into dust. Well, at the same time this was occurring, John happened to be in Normandy, laying siege to an English city. But he believed that if he basically stopped the siege and raced south to go fight the Black Prince, that that would be unkingly. So, what does he decide to do? Well, he made two mistakes. One, he decides to bribe the city. So instead of having to break the siege by warfare, he basically paid off all the English soldiers, so that way they would surrender. But when he gave out all that money, he no longer had enough money to pay for his army. So he decides to send home whatever infantry he had, because he believed he could win with just cavalry. So he then began marching south. Problem was, the Black Prince heard John was coming. So he picked a location just south of Poitiers. And just like at his father's battle a decade before, he picked a location on the top of a hill. And then they prepared defensive positions. They dug pits and they covered them up, put spikes in them. They dug trenches. They basically did everything they could to make it impossible to maneuver across the land with horses. Then, when John's cavalry arrived and he saw the Black Prince with his fortress up on top of the hill, the Black Prince basically started trying to make fun of the king's masculinity or lack thereof. Well, John didn't take the bait. So what ends up happening? Black Prince says, oh, what if we do this? He orders his supply train, which is on the other side of the hill, to break camp and to feign like it's retreating. But unbeknownst to the French spies, there was nobody in the wagons. All of the soldiers were hiding in all of the defensive positions that they had made on top of the hill. So when John hears that the English are retreating, what does he do? He orders his army to race up the hill. And just at the last moment, the English come out and he's like, oh, wah, 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 wah. Nearly 9,000 French soldiers were killed. And by the way, John himself was captured. He was taken back to England and held hostage. Now, by the way, unlike what they show in Hollywood, during this time, it was perceived to be bad form to kill a king. Instead, you would take them prisoner and you would hold them hostage, and you would demand a ransom. Which, because the king was the king, the country would thus be obligated to pay. Well, while being held hostage, Edward, still king, and John would hammer out an agreement that should have settled the war, the Treaty of London. And to make it real simple, Edward would get all of England's land back in France that had been in place going back 100 years. So all of the lands that were lost, it would all come back. Those lands, though, would be severed from France. They no longer would be considered part of France, but rather, they would be treated as an independent kingdom. Oh, and money. Lots and lots of money. How much? Well, coins that were used then were called an ekü. E-C-U, pronounced ekü, or ekai. Each coin was roughly 3.75 ounces of gold. So to get the modern equivalent, what's the going rate for gold per ounce right now? Hurry, someone look it up. Look it up. You all have your little devices. Current market rate gold per ounce. God, I probably thought it was itself. I think you guys were all like digitally oriented and stuff. Anybody? Bueller? You're killing me here, Holmes. Somebody!
$2,840.
Thank you. It's $2,800 per ounce. Alright? So that meant each coin in modern money is roughly $11,000. Multiply that by 4 million coins. That's the mother load. Well, here's the thing. John sat back and said, fine, I'll agree to it. I lost. But the problem is in order for the treaty to be endorsed, the gathering of the nobles in France had to endorse it. And they said, no effing way. No one person is worth this. So they rejected it. Well, when that occurred, the Black Prince came back, ready to do more damage until France capitulated. This time, instead of marching from the south, he came right across to Calais, up in Flanders, and basically began going south towards Paris. But the army that he was able to assemble, even though they were able to cause devastation for 6 months, was unable to take control of either Reims or Paris. Those cities were just too heavily defended. So, the Black Prince would negotiate an armistice with his counterpart, the Dauphin, Prince Charles. The Black Prince and the Prince Charles would negotiate the Treaty of Brittany. And the terms were simple. The Black Prince would essentially be known as the Lord of Aquitaine. all of these lands would become his personal property, not his father's. And Edward would not have to pay homage. So while all the lands wouldn't be removed, like under the Treaty of London, they would still technically be part of France, Edward didn't have to bend the knee. Oh, and the ransom would be reduced, because Charles basically told Edward, we don't have the money. So it would be dropped by roughly 25%. So from 4 million EK down to 3. B-I-N-G-O. I know, that's fine. All right, questions. So now we have another treaty. We have an agreed ceasefire, an armistice. The war technically is over. And for the next 9 years, there would be peace between the two nations. Now, during the 9 years, some wicked bizarre stuff happened, and I'm not going to hold you accountable on the test. But I already did the research, so I'll go through it, but you don't have to remember it. So originally, John was a prisoner in the Tower of London. But because he was a king, he wasn't a prisoner per se. So he was given royal privileges. So he didn't stay in a cell that was... Any of you ever been to London? Any of you ever go to Tower of London? Been there? No. So the Tower of London is basically not just a tower, it's a castle. And there are some very fancy living quarters in the complex. So the king was not placed with the common rabble, the prisoners, but rather he lived in one of these luxury apartments. And he could leave the Tower of London, the fort, whenever he wanted. Of course, he always had an escort. And of course, he was always fed. He was always well clothed. He was always treated respectfully. There is a story in the Tower of London that talked about one of the parks that he used to like to go visit. It's no longer a park. There's like apartment buildings there. But he liked going there because apparently there was a weird breed of bird that was striking color. And the king was like a painter. But when he learned of this treaty, and he also had heard that the nobles accepted this treaty, John was allowed to go to France. Because John had to go back and actually get the money. So what did they do? They did a prisoner swap. John could go back to France, but John's second son, Louis, or Louis, would come and sit in his father's place. But because of all the devastation that the Black Prince had caused over the last decade plus, the French economy, plus the Black Plague, the French economy was in ruins. There was no money to be raised. So, even though John began demanding that the nobles raise taxes so that way he can pay the ransom and get his son back, the nobles were like, sorry, dude, but there was no money. You can't get blood from a stone. Then to make that worse, Louis was not an honorable kid. He would actually break out, somehow get out of London, and return to Paris. Went to the palace and was like, hi, Dad, look at me! Which pissed John off, because John was a man of honor. So I'm sure he beat his son. But he sent word to the nobles, they had to raise the funds, and he himself got on a boat, went back to London. Sadly, before the funds could be raised, John dies. 1364, during another uptick in the plague that devastated London. Well, with John dead, Charles V comes in as king. But he doesn't do anything because he's dealing with a war that erupts down here. in modern Spain. Because he has territories that border the part of Spain that was called Castile. Well, at the same time, the Black Prince is also distracted because in Aquitaine, there was an uprising. Because the peasants could not afford the taxes that the Black Prince was demanding. So you got both guys distracted. That would go on for 4 years. Until my notes. Charles, as King of France, starts hearing complaints from the people of Aquitaine. Because of the Treaty of Brittany, Aquitaine is still part of France. Had they been operating under the Treaty of London, it would have been its own country. But that was not what they agreed to. This is what they agreed to. So, even though Edward, the Black Prince, is lord, he is still technically a vassal to the king. Which means the people of Aquitaine are the subjects of the king. So, 1369, we all good with this? 1369, Charles demands that his lord, the Black Prince, travel to Paris and basically explain what's going on. The Black Prince refuses. Why? Well, because a revolution would erupt. When the people of Aquitaine learned that their lord did not answer the call to the king, they rose up and rebelled. But this rebellion would cause the Black Prince to basically get bogged down. Aquitaine would be like a quagmire. Because the moment he suppressed an uprising in one village, another uprising would occur. And in the end, he was like playing whack-a-mole. But unfortunately, 1371, a widespread dysentery epidemic, drinking poopy water, diarrhea-ing himself to death. In the end, he would fall sick, go back to England, and die. With the death of the Black Prince, England had a huge problem. He had been the war leader for 30 years. There was nobody in England that was his equal, except his father. But his father was in his late 60s by this point. So he was not doing a battle. Plus, Edward III was also sick. So, one side, there's no one really in charge on the English effort. Which is the reason why the second mini war, there was no major big battles. There was no massive movements of armies or maneuvering. To a degree, it was a lot of just chaos. The reason being, the French started campaigning and no one was fighting back. So you really can't call it a battle when your army marches onto a village and the people are like, liberation! focus his time on Brittany. And in Brittany, there was some resistance. Not stiff, but some.
It was also during this war that Edward would die in 1377. But of course, we had a problem, because he outlived all of his sons, particularly his heir apparent, the Black Prince.
So the crown would be passed to his grandson, who was only 10 years old. And how much battling can a 10-year-old do?
Not much. And poor Richard's reign was awful. There would be several peasant uprisings, angry over all of the taxes that the English people were paying for these wars in France.
Plus, a war with Scotland would erupt again. So England was a poop show.
So, you really can't even call the Second Mini War a Second Mini War,
because as you can now see by the color change, Charles pretty much conquered almost all of France
with little to no resistance.
All that was left was the port area in and around Calais, up here, tip of Brittany, some lanes in Aquitaine and Gascony.
And everything was trending his way.
So what does he do? He nullifies the Treaty of Brittany. Basically says, we're not going to pay the debt. The heir of the Black Prince no longer has complete sovereignty in Aquitaine. That's now back to France.
But he gets himself into problems, because he had to raise taxes, which results in peasant uprisings. Plus, as we're going to see, he started getting involved in an event called the Great Schism. A period of time when the Pope was not only in Rome, but there was an anti-Pope in France. So for a period of time, there were two popes. And of course, the king had to stick his nose into it. Now, by 1380, Charles realizes, okay, technically we've been at war for 11 years, but there has been no battles, there's been no violence. Let's just end this stupid thing. But before he could negotiate, he dies. And when he dies, he's succeeded by his 11-year-old son, Charles VI. So how can you have two countries fighting against one another when both of their sovereigns are kids? You can't. So, facing mess after mess after mess, the nobles of France and England basically decide this is a stupid war, so let's hammer out a truce. Both sides pledge not to fight one another for 3 years. But in the end, it would last longer. It would end up lasting almost 16 years. No, wait, I did the math wrong. 26 years. Bless you. Why did this 3-year truce last this long? Well, again, there was no peace in either country. We don't have time to deal with everything, but just think, if something could break and happen, it was happening. In England, there was a coup d'etat against Richard. He was deposed, and his nephew would seize the throne, Henry IV. And poor Richard was locked up in a tower and starved to death. But we don't really have much to say about the reign of Henry IV because he faced almost non-stop peasant uprisings. The Scots rebelled, as did Wales. It was a mess.
Although I don't know if Charles VI was better off, because he had so many problems, he literally went insane. Charles VI is known to history as the Mad King.
He heard voices, he saw figments, he suffered breakdowns, probably depression. And then when all of the nobles saw that the king was insane, a civil war erupted. When some powerful nobles was like, why do we have a madman ruling our country? Let's get him out and I'll take the throne.
In the end, the civil war would only come to an end when the major challenger, one of Charles's uncles, was assassinated.
But for 10 years, the French were fighting the French, continuing the devastation. Man, these dark ages were messed up.
Well, we've got one more round to go. And then we're going to bring it all home. Questions? Regents fight for power. Okay. I said civil war, so if you wrote that down, you're good. It's a regent, by the way. Anyone know? Regent?
It's kind of like a guardian. It's someone who rules in the name of. I thought I mentioned that last class.
So if you have a kid on the throne, you have adults that basically serve as like prime ministers, chancellors. All right.
The last and final round would commence in 1415. At a time when really tensions were beginning to escalate on both sides of the English Channel. Primarily because both sides started engaging in piracy. They started sending bands that would go and raid the coastlines of both countries.
They would also try to attack merchant ships and make them disappear, steal the cargo, steal the contents. It was not good.
Well, in 1413, Henry IV died, and he would be succeeded by his son, who would be crowned Henry V. Henry V was the Black Prince incarnate. He actually led his father's armies on the battlefield. It was he who crushed the peasant uprising. So it was he who crushed the Welsh. When he became king, he first sent warning to France, stop raiding our coasts. And when that did not come back, he basically said, well, I want all my traditional lands, all my French lands returned to me. And he declared war. As significant as Poitiers and Crécy was, this final round saw two of the most famous battles in all of the Middle Ages. One battle is still celebrated today in England. And that was the Battle of Agincourt. October 1415. Henry crosses the English Channel, begins marching from Calais south near the village of Agincourt. Henry arrived first. He also was personally leading his soldiers. He was an alpha male's alpha male. But his army was outnumbered 3-1. He only had about 8,000 soldiers, and most of them were archers. Well, when the French got word of his arrival, the regents, because it wasn't the king, Charles was mad, the regents gathered an army and sent it north, over 25,000 men. 10,000 knights, 10,000 infantry, and France for the first time deployed an entire battle force, 5,000 men armed with crossbows, because technology had advanced. Crossbows, y'all know what crossbows are, right? Easier to fire. You don't have to be as physically strong as an English longbow. But the English longbow still has a range that's twice as far. Because Henry was there first, he picked the site. And man, did he find a good site for a battlefield. He found a spot where, located in a field, or near a field, was a good size opening that stood between two massive old growth forests. Behind him, easily defensive hills, or hills that could be defended. So, essentially, the only way to get to the English, and by the way, he arranged all his soldiers in an old-fashioned Greek phalanx. So they're standing side by side. The only way to get to him is to basically charge across the battlefield, which so happened to be a field. Do any of you know anything about Flanders? Flanders, just FYI, during World War I, saw some of the most harshest fighting that occurred in all of the entire World War because of the topography of Flanders. It has a very low height in comparison to sea level. So as a result, the water table is very, very high. So, I don't know how far you would have to dig down, but you only have to go a few feet before you hit water. Well, as it turns out, the field had recently been plowed. So it's soft soil. So soft, you can't go racing across it with a heavy war horse. You have to dismount. So, just like battle that happened twice before, same similar conditions. The French were forced to give up their advantage and march waist deep through the mud. Why the hell would they charge? You know what Henry didn't do? Henry didn't deploy all his archers. All you saw were the infantry. Guys with pikes. Guess where he put all his archers? No. In all the trees, in the woods. So as the French slowly trod forward, just at the point when they arrive right before the lines, the English longbowmen begin opening fire, creating a crossfire situation, and they absolutely slaughtered them. Over 6,000 French soldiers, including 120 great lords of France, died. Another 2,000 POWs were taken. The English only lost 112. This was a huge victory. Huge. History making. By the way, they still celebrate the Battle of Agincourt today in England. France, its fighting forces were decimated. Among the great lords were the three top regents of France, dead. Henry essentially cut off the head of the French government. All he had to do was take his army and march on Paris. The mad king probably would have let him in. But what does Henry do? Oh, he thinks he's freaking Julius Caesar. Wait, oh, I thought there was a click. It's not coming up. Instead of conquering, he goes back to England, goes to London, and literally throws himself a Roman-style triumph. A parade through the city, where they show off all the armors and all the banners that they captured of all the dead French, and march through all the POWs. Has celebrations and meet fields and parties. Stupid, 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 stupid. But he would come back, and within just 2 years, he managed to conquer almost all of northern France. Now, had he not waited, he probably could have ruled over everything. But we'll call that hubris. Not only did he conquer, but he also made a powerful ally, the Duke of Normandy. I mean, Burgundy, which is this part of France. So with the English and the Burgundian forces, this allied army basically could match anything the French could throw at them in terms of numbers. And then something happened. Not quite sure. But once this alliance was formed, the Mad King sent word that he's ready to negotiate. Henry travels to the city of Troyes, meets with the Mad King, and would actually get the king's signature on a treaty. Another treaty that should have ended this war. The Treaty of Troyes. How are you going to end the war? Simple. First, you're going to make a marriage. Henry would take as his wife Charles's daughter, Catherine. Very similar to what Philip IV and Longshanks did by marrying Isabella to Edward II. You combine the two households. But in the treaty, the French law was changed. And it was declared that any son born of that marriage would be Charles VI's heir. In other words, they named the future prince the King of France, as well as the King of England. And thus, the kingdoms would have become one. But there's a problem. The problem is Charles VI has an adult son, a Dauphin. That's kind of like the Prince of Wales, the heir apparent. So in order for the son of Henry and Catherine to become king, Charles VI had to disinherit his own son. Which he did, because he was insane. But Prince Charles, the Dauphin, refused to accept it. So he went south and started building an army. Which, of course, forced Henry to pursue. Because he needed him dead. Henry's forces managed to pursue the king, the prince, at a rapid pace. Catches him at the city of Meaux is down here. Lay siege to the city, surround it, prepares to starve him out. But during the siege, the king drank poopoo water, and Henry would die of dysentery. Now, by the way, at this point, Henry and Catherine did produce a son named Henry, who was 9 months old. Henry would be acknowledged as King of England and, because of the treaty, would be allowed to go to Reims. And he would actually be crowned King of France. Essentially making him a co-ruler. But 2 months later, Charles VI died. And the nobles of France decided we're not going to take a now 11-month-old king as our king. We're going to rip up the Treaty of Troyes, and we are going to pledge our support to the Dauphin. We want Prince Charles to be King of France. You know how many times I had to teach this class to get that down? Holy cow. That's what happens when you try cramming 100 years of history into a class, period. So now, yeah, what does this mean? The war is still going. But I just want to take a little mental break. I'll give you a little more and then we'll call it a day. I want to repeat, on the exams, I'm not going to dig this deep down the weeds. The reason why I'm giving you these details is I got to do it so I can kind of make sense of it. And again, your book does talk a little bit about it. I think they do it on a more generalized manner. But again, some of the facts, some of the instances are interesting, at least according to me. All right, let's talk about the second most famous battle in the Middle Ages.
treaty being ignored, the war technically is on. But, obviously, the 11-month-old Henry VI can't fight his own battles. Regents would appear and the nobles would basically take over the English army. Whereas Charles now has some legitimacy because the French nobles support him. But in order for Charles to become king, he has to go to Reims, which is right there, currently in English possession, as is Paris. So, in order for Charles to become King Charles, he basically needs to drive to northern France. But the problem is there was a whole bunch of cities that were fortified. So to get there, you would have to lay siege to each one. And it's one of the first major sieges that would break out around the time the Treaty of Troyes was ripped up. The Siege of Orléans. Now, this siege began in 1428. And it would last all the way until May 1429. In the end, even though it looked like England was going to win, the French somehow pulled out a victory. They pulled out a victory not with any super weapon, not with any brilliant new tactics, not with like betrayal, but they won because of a girl. Joan of Arc. In April 1429, the 17-year-old peasant girl appeared on the scene. And word started spreading throughout France that she was blessed. Apparently, she had been having visions since around the time of her being 13. She claimed that not only did the archangel, Saint Michael, himself come down to earth and speak with her, but she was also speaking with two saints, two martyrs, Saint Catherine and Saint Margaret. Apparently, for 4 years, these angels had been encouraging her, educating her, preparing her for the big transformative event of her lifetime. She would get Charles crowned king. She would lead the French to victory, to recapture the city of Reims, and would bring an end to the war. Well, here's the weird thing. Before she got to Orléans, in March, she actually traveled to where the Dauphin had his court. Now, legend has it that Joan and the Dauphin had never met before. But when Charles gave his consent for her to come to his court, he decided to play a little game, just to test whether or not the angels were on her side. So what he did was he had one of his servants dress up as king and sit up on the throne, and he instead dressed like a courtier, one of the officials at court, and kind of stood in the crowd, but in the back. Well, as the story has it, when Joan entered the chamber and she looked at who was on the throne, she walked forward, and about midway down the hall, or the room, she stopped suddenly, looked to her left, and went to the back of the line
and bent a knee right before the prince. Now, how was she able to identify him? Who knows? But she literally picked him out of a crowd. And that made the prince sit back and say, okay, well, maybe she does have a gift. Joan, of course, would soon convince Charles, let me go to Orléans. I will bring you victory. Now, of course, the weirdest thing is, Charles really had nothing to lose. Because if she went and managed to pull out a victory, he would look great. But if she went and she was just some stupid little girl and happened to die along the way, who would know? But nonetheless, when she arrived, amazing things started taking place. In particular, she would raise the morale of the French soldiers. She clad herself in a suit of white armor and would carry her banner. This picture shows her holding a sword, never actually held a sword because she was not physically strong enough to hold and use a sword. She was about 4'9", tops, maybe 95 pounds if even. How much use do you think she would have swinging a 10-pound broadsword? But she did have a banner that had a cross on it. And what she would do is she would act like a cheerleader. And she would run through the crowds and rally the French soldiers, telling them to attack over there or to attack over there, basically taking command control. And at first, the French soldiers were like, yeah, like we're going to follow a girl. But when she began emasculating them, calling them out for being cowards, guys were like, hey, you're not going to call me a coward. And they started fighting back. But as the battle began to turn, and slowly the siege began to break, even the soldiers were convinced, the angels are on our side. God wants the French to win. Damn it. Well, we'd have to leave it there. I have to pick it up on Thursday. Questions? All right, so just to warn you, my intention is to possibly give you enough information for the first exam after Thursday's class. So if I'm able to get where I want to get to, you will have your first exam. I'm going to let you pick when you take it, because it's going to be on Engage. You can basically have it on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. Your choice. But next class, I'll have a vote, if I get to that point. So if you've missed any classes, all the lectures are posted. Listen, get the notes, so you can be ready for it. All right?